So when she left the White House and decided to run for the U.S. Senate from her new home in New York State, something no First Lady, not even Eleanor Roosevelt, had dared to do, I was blindsided by the hostility toward her from some women. They called her cold, calculating, ambitious, and even unfeminist for using political experience gained as a wife. These were not the right-wing extremists who had accused the Clintons of everything from perpetrating real estate scams in Arkansas to murdering a White House aide with whom Hillary supposedly had an affair. On the contrary, they mostly agreed with her on the issues. Yet some were so opposed to her that they came to be called Hillary haters. It took me weeks of listening on the road to begin to understand why. In living rooms from Dallas to Chicago, I noticed that the Hillary haters often turned out to be the women most like her, white, well-educated, and married to or linked with powerful men. They were by no means all such women, but their numbers were still surprising. Also, they hadn't objected to sons, brothers, and sons-in-law using family connections and political names to further careers, say the Bushes or the Rockefellers or the Kennedys, yet they objected to Hillary doing the same. The more they talked, the more it was clear that their own husbands hadn't shared power with them. If Hillary had a husband who regarded her as an equal, who had always said this country got two presidents for the price of one, it only dramatized their own lack of power and respect. After one long night and a lot of wine, one woman told me that Hillary's marriage made her aware of just how unequal hers was. In San Francisco and Seattle, I listened to self-identified Hillary haters condemn her for staying with her husband despite his well-publicized affairs. It turned out that many of them had suffered a faithless husband, too, but lacked the ability or the will to leave. They wanted Hillary to punish a powerful man in public on their behalf. I reminded them that presidents from Roosevelt to Kennedy had affairs, but the haters identified with those first ladies and assumed they couldn't leave. It was Hillary's very strength and independence that made them blame her. When I tried describing the public condemnation Hillary would have suffered had she abandoned her duties in the White House for such a personal reason, this changed the minds of some. But not many. Finally, I resorted to explaining my own reasons for thinking the Clintons just might be, in Shakespeare's phrase, the marriage of true minds. I had seen them together for a long afternoon during a White House ceremony for recipients of the Medal of Freedom. One medalist was my friend, Wilma Mankiller, chief of the Cherokee Nation. She and I were both struck by the obvious connection between the Clintons as they walked from one group of awardees and their families to the next, talking to guests and each other. In a room full of interesting people, they seemed just as interested in listening and talking to each other. What they were sharing, I don't know, but what was clear was their intimacy and pleasure in each other's company. Of how many long married couples could that be said? Yet, when I brought this up, some Hillary haters became even angrier. Many were longtime wives, and others were new wives replacing older ones, but the fact that Bill valued Hillary as an equal partner and vice versa seemed to make them more aware that their own marriages were different. It dawned on me that if a sexual connection is the only bond between a husband and wife, an affair can make her feel replaceable, and perhaps cause her to be replaced. This was not only emotionally painful, but devastating when it also meant losing social identity and economic security as well. I began to understand that Hillary represented the very public, in-your-face opposite of the precarious and unequal lives that some women were living. In a classic sense, they were trying to kill the messenger. Their projections made me realize that I was projecting too. I couldn't understand why Hillary wanted to go back to Washington and so campaigned for the Senate in the first place. After 8 years in the White House with political piranhas circling and every move accompanied by hostile lawsuits and media attacks from ultra-right-wing groups spending unlimited money on anti-Clinton conspiracy theories, why ask for 6 more years in the Senate with a target painted on her back? It seemed quixotic and self-punishing, especially now that she had such great alternatives as creating her own foundation and supporting female empowerment globally. Finally, I had to admit that the latter would have been my choice, not hers. If she was willing to face a degree of combat that I couldn't even imagine, I should celebrate. As my own part of her Senate campaign, I began to invite Hillary haters to the living room events where Hillary herself was fundraising. To my surprise, all but a few turned around once they had spent time in her presence. This woman they had imagined as smart, cold, and calculating turned out to be smart, warm, and responsive. Instead of someone who excused a husband's behavior, she was potentially, as one said, a great girlfriend who had their backs. They also saw her expertise. For instance, George Soros, the Hungarian-born financier and philanthropist, introduced her in his Manhattan living room by saying, "Hillary knows more about Eastern Europe than any other American." After she was elected to the U.S. Senate on her own merits, she worked constructively, even with old enemies there, and was solidly re-elected to a second term. I began to hear the first serious talk of Hillary Clinton as a presidential candidate. By the time the election of 2008 was in the wind, she had a higher popularity rating than any other potential candidate, Republican or Democrat. Meanwhile, I knew from campaigning in Illinois with Voters for Choice that a young two-term state legislator named Barack Obama had helped defeat a bill designed to weaken Roe v. Wade there. But when I went to the 2004 Democratic Convention in Boston, I was as surprised as the rest of the country to watch his inspirational blockbuster of a speech. His rise was much more like a movement event than politics as usual. After his election to the U.S. Senate, Obama appeared at a living room fundraiser in Manhattan to celebrate and to help pay off his campaign debt. I watched as supporters urged him to disobey traditional rules for a freshman senator and refused to follow the quiet example of the newly elected. He was reluctant, citing his need to learn and the power of the Bush presidency. I urged him, too. After all, everybody knew that George W. Bush would never have become president without his family, and everybody also knew that Obama had become senator against all odds. By the following year, progressive forces looking for a new candidate, not just in the Senate, but for the presidency, were approaching him with offers to, as Obama said, drink the Kool-Aid. Though he resisted at first, the draft effort gradually became a movement with a life of its own. Though such African-American leaders as Congresswoman Shirley Chisholm and Reverend Jesse Jackson had run, Obama became the first with a serious chance of being a major party candidate. Together, he and Hillary could turn this election into the first in history with candidates who looked like the country. It wasn't campaign season yet, but wherever I went, from campuses to living rooms, questions about the possibility of a new kind of president were being raised. Though Obama was younger with less national, international, and Senate experience than Hillary, I still thought it was too soon for the country to accept a woman commander-in-chief. Moreover, Obama's Kennedy-esque appeal created a rare and precious chance to break the racial barrier. But to me, their shared content was way more important than different forms. She was a civil rights advocate, he was a feminist. They were a modern-day echo of the abolitionist and suffragist era, when black men, black women, and white women, the groups white male supremacists had worked so hard and cruelly to keep apart, turned this country on its head by working together for universal adult suffrage. Whenever I was on the road before the primaries, I saw a revival of this unconscious coalition in audiences that were interested in politics as never before. There was enthusiasm for these two new faces that stood for a shared worldview. In audiences from very blue states to very red ones, support was more like a Rorschach test than a division by race and sex. For instance, 94% of black Democrats had a favorable view of Hillary Clinton compared to an 88% favorable view of Obama. After all, He was new on the national stage, and the Clintons had earned a reputation for racial inclusiveness that caused African-American novelist Toni Morrison to famously call Bill Clinton the first black president. Both white and black women were more likely than their male counterparts to support Hillary Clinton, and in my observation, also more likely to believe that she couldn't win. Male and female black voters were more likely than white voters to support Obama and also to believe he couldn't win. Each group was made pessimistic by the depth of the bias they had experienced. Some mostly white audiences seemed to hope this country could expiate past sins by electing Obama. As one white music teacher rose in an audience to say, "Racism puts me in prison too, a prison of guilt." Many parents of little girls, black and white, were taking them to Clinton rallies so they would know that they, too, could be president. Older women especially saw Hillary Clinton as their last and best chance to see a woman in the White House. And not just any woman. As one said, this isn't just about biology. We don't want a Margaret Thatcher who cut off milk for school children. They wanted Hillary Clinton because she supported the majority interests of women. On the other hand, many young black single mothers said they supported Obama because their sons needed a positive black male role model. A divorced white father told me that Obama's life story had inspired him to drive hundreds of miles to see his son every week. "I don't want to be the father Obama almost never saw," he explained. "I want to be the father he wished he had." In Austin, Texas, an 80-year-old black woman said she was supporting Hillary because, "I've seen too many women who earned it and too many young men who came along and took it." But the press, instead of reporting on these shared and often boundary-crossing views as an asset for the Democratic Party, after all, Democratic voters would have to unify around one of these candidates eventually, responded with disappointment and even condescension. They seemed to want newsworthy division. Soon, frustrated reporters were creating conflict by turning any millimeter of difference between Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama into a mile. Since there was almost none in content, they emphasized ones of form. Clinton was entirely summed up by sex, and Obama was entirely summed up by race. Journalists sounded like sports fans who arrived for a football game and were outraged to find all the players on the same team. It dawned on me that in the abolitionist and suffragist past, a universal suffragist movement of black men and white and black women also had been consciously divided by giving the vote to black men only, and then limiting even that with violence, impossible literacy tests, and poll taxes. Now, this echo of divide and conquer in the past was polarizing the constituencies of two barrier-breaking firsts. Never mind that the candidates were almost identical in content. As in history, a potentially powerful majority was being divided by an entrenched, powerful few. Maybe attributing a divide-and-conquer motive was unfair in a country that treats everything like a horse race, but there had to be some reason why the press did not consider what I witnessed on the road. Delight in two firsts with similar purpose, worth reporting. Soon a person or a group's choice of one candidate was assumed to be a condemnation of the other. I could feel fissures opening up between people who had been allies on issues for years. The long knives of reporters, plus a few short-sighted partisans in both campaigns, deepened those fissures until they bled. To make a case for linking racism and sexism instead of ranking them, and for unifying around one of these two firsts in the national election, I wrote a New York Times op-ed titled "Coalition versus Competition." I called either-or media questions dumb and destructive, since the two candidates were so much the same on issues. Also, it was way too soon to know who could survive the primaries, so I ended this way: we could double our chances by working for one of these candidates, not against the other. For now, I've figured out how to answer reporters when they ask if I am supporting Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama. I just say yes. As the New York primary approached, I certainly wasn't against either candidate, but I still had to decide who to vote for. So I sat down with a yellow pad and made a list of pros and cons for each. On the issues, there were differences of emphasis, but both wanted a country in which individual futures were not limited by sex or race, class or sexuality. Both advocated a foreign policy that was less about oil and support for dictators and more about support for democracies and the environment. Hillary had voted in the Senate for the first U.S. military action in Iraq, and some Obama supporters were making much of that. But Obama himself was honest enough to say that had he been in the Senate at that time and given the same false information about Iraq's weapons of mass destruction, he didn't know how he would have voted. The only obvious difference was experience. As a partner, Hillary Clinton had spent 12 years in state government, 8 in the White House, plus 8 more on her own in the U.S. Senate, all of them fighting the right-wing extremists who controlled what once was the Republican Party. The next president would face the same opposition. Obama had crucial multicultural experience growing up, time spent as an organizer in Chicago that meant a lot to me, 7 years in a state legislature, 3 years in the U.S. Senate, but much less experience fighting and being attacked by the political ultra-right wing. Both the good and the bad news was that he was a peacemaker and skilled in the art of finding a middle path. This primary race was a rare case in which the female candidate was more experienced in big-time political conflict than the male candidate. She was more familiar with extremists for whom there was no middle ground. I knew that outside the women's movement, I would be better liked if I chose Obama. Women are always better liked if we sacrifice ourselves for something bigger. And something bigger always means including men, even though something bigger for men doesn't usually mean including women. In choosing Hillary, I would be seen as selfish for supporting a woman like me. But that was a warning, too. Needing approval is a female cultural disease and often a sign of doing the wrong thing. There was one more note on my yellow pad. Because I still believed it was too soon for Hillary or any woman to be accepted as commander-in-chief, I wrote, "If I were Obama, I would not feel personally betrayed by lack of support from someone like me, a new ally. If I were Hillary Clinton, I might feel betrayed by a longtime supporter who left me for a new face." In other words, Obama didn't need me to win. Hillary Clinton might need me to lose. Once again, the road educated me by showing me what voters were subjected to. I began to think that the wait for a female president might be even longer than I imagined. At airport gift shops, a nutcracker made to look like Hillary Clinton was sold as an election novelty. Her legs were handles, and her crotch was the place for cracking nuts. When I asked a sales clerk in the Washington, D.C. airport if there were complaints, she said yes. There had been a few, but it was selling well. When I asked her if there were similar nutcrackers of the male candidate, she said, "Certainly not." On campuses, I saw young men wearing T-shirts that said, "Too bad O.J. didn't marry Hillary." All the wearers I saw were white. When I asked students what they thought about this slogan, they agreed it was uncool. They assured me most guys just put on their T-shirts and Facebook pages, "Bros before hoes." I watched as MSNBC political analyst Tucker Carlson said of Hillary Clinton, "I have often said when she comes on television, I involuntarily cross my legs." I thought, no wonder that nutcracker is selling well. Also on MSNBC, Chris Matthews announced, "Let's not forget, and I'll be brutal, the reason she's a U.S. senator, the reason she's a candidate for president, the reason she may be a front runner, is her husband messed around. That's how she got to be senator from New York. We keep forgetting it. She didn't win there on her merit." A woman reporter for the Washington Post wrote about a Hillary suit jacket that disclosed a bit of cleavage and called it a provocation. No such charge had been leveled at male presidential candidates from John F. Kennedy to Obama when they were photographed on the beach in bathing suits. About Hillary, Rush Limbaugh asked, "Will this country want to actually watch a woman get older on a daily basis?" According to another Fox News analyst, if that's the face of experience, I think it's going to scare away a lot of those independent voters. At CNN, women correspondents told me they had been cautioned not to wear pantsuits on camera. They might look too much like Hillary. All this reductionist commentary might have been fair game had it been directed at all the primary candidates. Say, Senator Joe Biden's obvious hair transplants, or Senator John Edwards' resemblance to a Ken doll, or Governor Mitt Romney's capped teeth and dyed hair, or Senator John McCain's special shoes to make him taller, or Governor Bill Richardson's resemblance to an unmade bed, or Senator Obama's ears, about which he himself made jokes. But it wasn't. No wonder such misogyny was almost never named by the media. It was the media. In making my list about the pluses and minuses of Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama, I discovered I was angry. I was angry because it was okay for two generations of Bush sons to inherit power from a political patriarchy, even if they spent no time in the White House, but not okay for one Clinton wife to claim experience and inherit power from a husband whose full political partner she had been for 20 years. I was angry because young men in politics were treated like rising stars, but young women were treated like, well, young women. I was angry about all the women candidates who put their political skills on hold to raise children and all the male candidates who didn't. I was angry about the human talent that was lost just because it was born into a female body and the mediocrity that was rewarded because it was born into a male one. And I was angry because the media took racism seriously or pretended to, but with sexism, they rarely bothered even to pretend. Resentment of women still seemed safe, whether it took the form of demonizing black single mothers or making routine jokes about powerful women being ballbusters. In other cases of unadmitted bias, I had used the time-honored movement tactic of reversing the race or sex or ethnicity or sexuality involved, then seeing if the response would be the same. Fueled by months of repressed anger, I asked, what might have happened if even an empathetic man like Obama had been exactly the same person, but born female? I called the result A Short History of Change. The New York Times op-ed page changed it to Women Are Never Front Runners. Published on the morning of the New Hampshire primary, it asked why the sex barrier was not taken as seriously as the racial one. The reasons are as pervasive as the air we breathe. Because sexism is still confused with nature, as racism once was, because anything that affects males is seen as more serious than anything that affects only the female half of the human race, because children are still raised mostly by women, to put it mildly, so men especially tend to feel they are regressing to childhood when dealing with a powerful woman, because racism stereotyped black men as more masculine for so long that some white men find their presence to be masculinity affirming, as long as there aren't too many of them, and because there is still no right way to be a woman in public power without being considered a you-know-what. I'm not advocating a competition for who has it toughest. The caste systems of sex and race are interdependent and can only be uprooted together. It's time to take equal pride in breaking all the barriers. I added that I was supporting Hillary Clinton based only on her greater experience. About Obama, I wrote, if he's the nominee, I'll volunteer. To clean up the mess left by President Bush, we may need two terms of President Clinton and two of President Obama. The first response was overwhelmingly positive. Because Hillary Clinton unexpectedly won that New Hampshire primary, my column was even given some of the credit. The New York Times published a letter from a voter there to that effect. It was as if I'd written what many people were thinking. Most just seemed glad that I'd spoken up about the humiliation of a good woman. But then a few calls came in from interviewers, assuming that by supporting Hillary I was ranking sex over race, despite my lifetime of arguing that sexism and racism were linked, not ranked, and despite writing in that same op-ed that the caste systems of sex and race could only be uprooted together, I was seen as asking people to take sexism more seriously than racism. When I went on a television show, an Obama supporter, a black woman academic, accused me by saying that white women have been complicit in the oppression of black men and black women. She talked many times more than I did, mentioning lynching, and said, "To take this kind of position in the New York Times struck me as the very worst of what feminism can offer." I was left saying things like, "I refuse to be divided on this," and pointing out that whether Hillary or Obama won the primary, she and I would be united in the general election. Afterward, I felt as if I had been hit by a Mack truck. From then on, every morning brought new attacks. I came to dread the particular ring of my cell phone. Though I had been called many things, from a baby killer to a destroyer of the family, those had come from people with whom I really disagreed. These attacks came from people whose opinion I valued and who were accusing me of holding a position I didn't hold. Online, I discovered part of the reason. The Times had used an ambiguous pull quote to characterize the whole op-ed. Gender is probably the most restricting force in American life, whether the question is who must be in the kitchen or who could be in the White House. I meant that in terms of pervasiveness, kitchen to White House, not that it was more or less important. However, I realized with a sinking heart that I should have known in this context that most is a four-letter word. Only conflict is news, and in agreeing to edits on the phone, I had failed to make every sentence bulletproof. Definitely my fault. That quote was going around the world on the web and was seen by many more people than read the op-ed. I withdrew the whole thing from syndication by the New York Times, but it didn't matter. The attacks grew increasingly virulent. Anybody can be with you when you're right, but only friends are with you when you mess up. Many called to comfort me. At least one prominent African-American woman leader said she had been asked by the Obama campaign to launch a major attack against me and had refused. She told them I had earned the right to say what I thought. If hard things ultimately have a purpose, then they aren't so hard anymore. Therefore, I listed what I had learned. 1. It's easy to forget that people can think you think what you don't think. 2. Don't write when you're angry and under deadline, with time to test it only on friends who know what you mean, not on strangers who don't. 3. A writer's greatest reward is naming something unnamed that many people are feeling. A writer's greatest punishment is being misunderstood. The same words can do both. I also thought suddenly of the wisdom of my speaking partner, the late, generous, outrageous, matchless Flo Kennedy. She found value in conflict no matter what. The purpose of ass-kicking is not that your ass gets kicked at the right time or for the right reason, she often explained. It's to keep your ass sensitive. Remembering her words made me laugh out loud. Once Obama won, a few wise people in his and Hillary's campaigns, who had been in touch all along, knew there had to be a healing. With my friend and colleague Judy Gold, who was in charge of women's issues for Obama's campaign, I planned what we knew would be the first of many healing meetings. There were heartbroken older women who now knew they would never live to see a woman in the White House. There were younger ones who had grown up being told they could be anything, then been shocked by Hillary's treatment and defeat. African-American women and men who had supported Hillary also worried that some would punish them for working across racial lines. Oprah Winfrey and other women in public life who had supported Obama paid a price, too. Some criticized them for not supporting Hillary Clinton, since women were their main supporters and constituency. This was also true for Karen Mulhauser, a white woman and an important and longtime feminist leader who supported Obama. I had written and spoken in support of their right to choose Obama, and now they, too, helped to heal the wounds of Hillary Clinton's defeat. As my last campaign effort, I made hundreds of buttons that said, "Hillary supports Obama, so do I." Then I got on the plane to Washington, went to join the crowd at her historic and generous concession speech, in which she pledged her wholehearted support to Obama, and distributed the buttons to the audience. They were in great demand. All my years of campaigning have given me one clear message. Voting isn't the most we can do, but it is the least. To have a democracy, you have to want one. Still, I realize this fully only by looking back. At the beginning of the 1980s, I went to Missouri to campaign for Harriet Woods in her U.S. Senate race. She was a great candidate, and I empathized with the difficult time she'd had as a woman journalist. Her path into politics was so improbable that no one could have made it up. As a mother of two young children, she complained about a noisy manhole cover that awakened them every time a car rolled over it in her otherwise quiet street. When she got nowhere with the city council, she circulated a neighborhood petition to close the street to cars. It worked. This success led her to run for the city council. She won, served 8 years, got appointed to the State Highway Commission, ran a successful race for the state legislature, and was reelected there, too. She also became the producer of a much-loved local television show. All this made her a viable statewide candidate. Still, this was not enough for the state Democratic Party. When it came time to choose a primary candidate in a U.S. Senate race, it backed a well-to-do banker who had never run for anything, just written checks. To be fair, Woods might have seemed like a lost cause in Missouri, where no woman had ever won a statewide office. She also wasn't rich like the banker. But she turned out to have something more important than her party's blessing: community support and volunteers. She beat the rich guy 2-1. Suddenly, Harriet Woods was in a race with Republican Senator John Danforth. He was not only the incumbent, but a former Attorney General of Missouri, an ordained Episcopal priest, and the rich grandson of the founder of Ralston Purina. It was as if she were running against the entire patriarchy. When I went to campaign for her, I could see that all the new feminist electoral groups were working their hearts out. So were the volunteers in her statewide network. Though Missouri was often counted as an anti-choice state, Woods refused to budge from her support for reproductive freedom. In the end, she won in rural Republican areas anyway, including one so conservative that it was known as Little Dixie. But in the final week, she had run out of money and couldn't answer the last-minute storm of virulent attacks. She lost by less than 2% of the vote. This heartbreaking, hairbreadth defeat drew special attention, as did the fact that she had been the only female U.S. Senate candidate in the whole country from either party. It was so clear that she could have won with money to answer attacks that her race inspired the founding of Emily's List, a political action committee that supports pro-choice Democratic women candidates. As proof that even failure can be turned to good purpose, this PAC went on to attract 3 million members and become one of the biggest in the nation, as well as the single biggest resource for women in politics. But Danforth did win. He took with him to Washington an African-American lawyer named Clarence Thomas, who had been working for Monsanto, the agrochemical giant that gave us Agent Orange, genetically engineered seeds, and more. Indeed, Danforth got him that job, too. As Danforth explained, he was very attracted to Thomas, not only because he was a rare African-American conservative, but also because he, too, had studied to be a priest. In his case, a Catholic priest. All this happened decades ago. Woods died in 2007 from leukemia at the age of 79, yet the impact of her loss by a few hundred votes goes on. If you don't believe me, flash forward to the morning after the 2000 Bush versus Gore presidential election, with national results hanging by the thread of a few thousand disputed votes in Florida. I just happened to be speaking at Palm Beach County Community College that morning, a long-arranged event unrelated to any election, and its campus just happened to be in a poor area. I'd been asked to talk about social justice movements generally, but I could see that nobody wanted to talk about anything but the election cliffhanger that was upon us. A young African-American woman rose to say she'd registered to vote by phone, then been challenged at her polling place because Caucasian had been printed next to her name. She never did get to vote. An older African-American man said he had been denied the right to vote because he was told he had a felony conviction, yet he'd never been accused of a crime, much less convicted of one. Someone shouted out, "Yes, you have. It's called voting while black." Amid the laughter, another man stood to explain that names of people with felonies had been merged with the voter rolls without checking whether more than one person shared the same name. Then an older white woman said the bus from her retirement home had been sent to the wrong polling place. Others testified that polling places were fewer and lines were longer in poor and more democratic areas. People had given up because they were hourly workers who lost pay if they weren't at their jobs. Then a white man of 50 or so said he'd seen the illustration of the ballot only on the way out and realized he had accidentally voted for an extreme right-wing candidate when he thought he was voting for Al Gore. That caused a dozen more people to groan or shout out that this had also happened to them. One by one, people in this random audience told their confusing and disenfranchising experiences. Out of the approximately 700 people in the auditorium, at least 100 had been unable either to vote for their chosen candidate or to vote at all. I wondered, if there are this many in one auditorium, how many in all of Palm Beach County or in the state? Finally, a white man of 30 or so rose to face me. In the name of his military service to his country, he said, and also of his young daughter, whom he wanted to grow up in a democracy, he asked, "Will you stay and help us organize a protest tomorrow, and the next day, and the next, whatever it takes?" I could feel a deep pull to say yes, yet I thought my presence might be used to call this a rebellion instigated by an outsider. Instead, I promised to take the name, address, and polling place of everyone who hadn't been able to vote at all, or to vote for their chosen candidate, and give them to lawyers for Gore, as well as nonpartisan watchdogs outside the state. I went home, called election lawyers, and delivered the lists as promised. When Bush's lead was down to a mere 537 votes out of about 6 million cast, the reexamination of ballots was stopped. Florida's Secretary of State, Katherine Harris, also the co-chair of Bush's Florida campaign, declared Bush the winner. Calls for a recount were deafening and supported by the Florida Supreme Court. However, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled 5-4 that there was no uniform recount standard to meet the Equal Protection Clause and no time to create one. Therefore, the recount was stopped. It was a decision that would be compared with Dred Scott, the 19th century Supreme Court ruling that no black person, slave or free, could ever become a citizen of the United States, for its impact and clear bias. Remember, for want of a nail, the horseshoe was lost. For want of a horseshoe, the horse was lost. For want of a horse, the battle was lost. For want of a battle, the war was lost. This parable should be the mantra of everyone who thinks her or his vote doesn't count. If Harriet Woods hadn't been defeated by less than 2% of the votes in Missouri, Danforth wouldn't have been a U.S. senator. If Danforth hadn't been senator, Clarence Thomas wouldn't have gone with him to Washington as a staff member. If Thomas hadn't been visible in Washington as a rare African-American who opposed his community's majority views, he wouldn't have been appointed by the first President Bush to head and to disempower the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission and then to sit on the D.C. Court of Appeals. If Thomas hadn't been given such credentials, he couldn't have been nominated by the same President Bush to succeed the great civil rights advocate Justice Thurgood Marshall on the Supreme Court. If Thomas hadn't been on the Supreme Court, he couldn't have supplied the one-vote margin that halted the Florida court-ordered recount. If there had been a recount, Al Gore, not George W. Bush, would have been president, as was concluded by a post-election examination of all uncounted ballots commissioned by 12 major news organizations. If George W. Bush had not been president, the United States would have been less likely to lose the world's sympathy after 9/11 by launching the longest war in U.S. history, with more bombs dropped on Afghanistan during 14 years than in all of World War II, plus billions in tax dollars given to 20,000 private contractors and thousands killed and wounded on both sides. If Al Gore, not George W. Bush, had been president, global warming would have been taken seriously. Also, the United States would not have falsified evidence to justify invading oil-rich Iraq, thus starting an 8-year war and, together with Afghanistan, convincing some in Islamic countries that the United States is waging war against Islam. Without George W. Bush, there would not be the biggest transfer of wealth into private hands in the history of this nation, a pay ratio in which the average CEO earns 475 times more than the average worker. In Canada, it's 20 times. An executive order giving an estimated $40 billion in tax dollars to Catholic, evangelical, and other religious groups without congressional approval, often with the appearance of turning churches into a vote delivery system. Without Clarence Thomas to supply the one-vote majority, the Supreme Court might not have ruled that corporations are people, with a right to unlimited political spending in order to continue everything that's just been described. Well, you get the idea. The list goes on. We must not only vote, but fight to vote. The voting booth really is the one place on earth where the least powerful equal the most powerful. I still dream about that veteran and his daughter. I so wish I had said yes. I have no idea whether we in the room could have made a difference. In truth, we don't know which of our acts in the present will shape the future. We have to behave as if everything we do matters, because it might. As my mother would say, democracy is a seed that can only be planted where you are. A coda. Part of traveling over years means coming back to the same place and knowing it for the first time. I had learned my best political lesson in college. I just didn't know it yet. I took a course in geology because I thought it was the easiest way of fulfilling a science requirement. One day, the professor took us out into the Connecticut River Valley to show us the meander curves of an old-age river. I was paying no attention because I had walked up a dirt path and found a big turtle, a giant mud turtle about 2 feet across, on the muddy embankment of an asphalt road. I was sure it was going to crawl onto the road and be crushed by a car. So with a lot of difficulty, I picked up this huge snapping turtle and slowly carried it down the road to the river. Just as I had slipped it into the water and was watching it swim away, my geology professor came up behind me. "You know," he said quietly, "that turtle has probably spent a month crawling up the dirt path to lay its eggs in the mud on the side of the road. You have just put it back in the river." I felt terrible. I couldn't believe what I had done, but it was too late. It took me many more years to realize this parable had taught me the first rule of organizing. Always ask the turtle. Chapter 6. Surrealism in Everyday Life. A journey, whether it's to the corner grocery or through life, is supposed to have a beginning, middle, and end, right? Well, the road is not like that at all. It's the very illogic and the juxtaposed differences of the road, combined with our search for meaning, that make travel so addictive. Fortunately, I already had a phrase for this road craziness. As Suzanne Langer, the philosopher of mind and art, explained, the notion of giving something a name is the vastest generative idea that was ever conceived. It was the good luck and bad luck of writing for That Was the Week That Was, TW3, a pioneer of political satire on television, that caused me to create a category called Surrealism in Everyday Life. In 1963, a time of controversy over civil rights in Vietnam, political, scared network executives, and satire still evoked George S. Kaufman's show business adage, "Satire is what closes on Saturday night." Though TW3 would eventually become the parent of the much sillier Laugh-In, then of such true heirs as Saturday Night Live, The Daily Show with Jon Stewart, and The Colbert Report, the Continuity Acceptance Department, otherwise known as the censors, was in a snit of nervousness. Because the show really was live, if anyone departed from the script, the only remedy was to bleep a word or pull the plug completely. Censors also once tried to convince us that the fairness doctrine of the Federal Communications Commission required writing a pro-war joke for every anti-war joke. Fortunately, they couldn't think of a pro-war joke either. But limits lead to invention. My favorite skit got past the suits, as we mercilessly called all network executives, by hiring a juggler to toss huge butcher knives into the air and keep them circling overhead while the audience barely breathed. After what seemed an eternity, a stagehand appeared with a vaudeville-type placard, "The Nuclear Arms Race." Thanks to surrealism in everyday life, I could comment on such events as the high-rise bordellas being subsidized by the government of Holland. All I had to do was comb through the newspapers of the world every Saturday morning while also watching Soul Train, thus learning new disco moves at the same time, and search for the sort of events about which one says, "You can't make this stuff up." I was the only girl writer, probably because the power to make people laugh is also a power, so women had been kept out of comedy. Polls show that what women fear most from men is violence, and what men fear most from women is ridicule. Later, when Tina Fey was head writer and star of Saturday Night Live, she could still say, "Only in comedy does an obedient white girl from the suburbs count as diversity." TW3 was fun. It was pioneering. It couldn't last. But what did last was surrealism in everyday life, as a category in my mind. Never again would I be able to confront the unimaginable without imagining an award for it. When I began to travel as an organizer and was plunged into irrational juxtapositions on the road, I finally understood why laughter is a mark of wanderers, from the holy fools of old Russia to the roadies of rock music. It's the surprise, the unexpected, the out of control. It turns out that laughter is the only free emotion, the only one that can't be compelled. We can be made to fear. We can even be made to believe we're in love, because if we're kept dependent and isolated for long enough, we bond in order to survive. But laughter explodes like an aha. It comes when the punchline changes everything that has gone before, when two opposites collide and make a third, when we suddenly see a new reality. Einstein said he had to be very careful while shaving, because when he had an idea, he laughed, and he cut himself. Laughter is an orgasm of the mind. On the road, moments of surrealism may come and go in a second. I'm looking out the scenic window of a train speeding through miles of empty moonlit desert when acres of neatly arranged abandoned refrigerators flash by. They may also last for hours. I'm returning tired to a sterile hotel lobby and am invited into a reunion of the last living members of a Negro baseball league whose stories take me into another world. Since learning causes our brains to grow new synapses, I like to believe that the road is sharpening my mind and lengthening my life with surprise. It's 1997, toward the end of my third decade traveling as an organizer, and I'm speaking at a campus near Boston. The post-lecture discussion has lasted until midnight. The last plane to New York is long gone, and I must get home so I can leave on another trip in the morning. Fortunately, kind-hearted students come to my rescue with a local car service and even steal a pillow from a dorm so I can sleep all the way home. But once on the road, I'm still wide awake with post-lecture adrenaline. Also, the driver, a cheerful white guy in his 50s, wants to talk. As we make our way through a blinding rainstorm, he explains that we're safe because he used to be a cross-country trucker driving in all kinds of weather. He pulled down $200,000 a year and owned his own rig, but quit because he was a stranger to his wife and grandkids. Now that he owns this local car service, he has a family again. But still, he misses, really misses, his old cross-country life. What do you miss, I ask, imagining he'll say speed, going it alone, adrenaline, danger, everything I remember from the classic movie, They Drive by Night. I miss the community, he says. Since this isn't at all what I expected, I ask him to explain. He says, civilians just don't understand, and asks if I want to see for myself. We turn off the turnpike onto a service road. Near three gas pumps, I see several parked trucks, their huge shapes outlined by multicolored safety lights that shine through the black rain like Christmas. Behind them is a windowless shack that's dark except for a couple of neon beer signs. Opening the door is like throwing a switch. We're plunged into bright lights, laughter, music, the smell of fresh bread, and an energy level more like noon than 2 a.m. At the counter, we are served coffee in mugs as heavy as dumbbells, plus slabs of a pie that must have been big enough for 10 and 20 blackbirds. My driver and the waitress exchange news about who's still working, who's still married, who jackknifed a semi on black ice, and who was driving a rig that got blown over in a tornado. At least, I think that's what they're saying. Words like anteater, which is a kind of rig, and bear, which means a law enforcement officer, need translation. A bearded driver in cowboy boots sits down next to me. He orders lemon meringue pie, a side of chocolate ice cream, a pot of tea, and a can of motor oil. The waitress slides each item down the Formica counter to exactly the right spot in front of him, all with the skill of a great pool player. I compliment her. From there, we get to talking about women truck drivers. She says there are a few more these days. Fleet owners have begun to hire them because they listen to their trainers and have better safety records. Still, women get ribbed and talked dirty to on CB radio. She respects them for hanging in there and even driving 18-wheelers. What started as husband and wife teams, the pioneers of job sharing, one sleeping in the back of the cab while the other drove, has now become a crack in the glass ceiling of jobs with good pay. Over by the booths, one older white guy and two young black men are feeding coins into an old-fashioned jukebox and arguing about the relative merits of rappers versus classics like Stevie Wonder and Sam Cooke. They seem to agree that Brooke Benton's Rainy Night in Georgia is the trucker's anthem and play it three times straight. Just wait, my driver says. The next place has real trucker's music. Back on the shining highway, he explains that truck stops aren't chains of sameness like McDonald's. They're more like idiosyncratic relatives. Each one offers down-home food, talk, music, and timelessness, plus trucker necessities from motor oil to mosquito spray, all sold over the counter. When we turn off again and head into another warm, tacky, welcoming world, the jukebox features such songs as Girl on the Billboard, A Tombstone Every Mile, and 18 Wheels and a Dozen Roses, the last being the ode of a trucker coming home to his wife. Truckers are such constant listeners that they dictate pop music hits. Also, Nashville produces specialty truckers' songs as a profitable category. Who knew? At our third stop, I sit next to a truck-driving wife. She started teaming up with her husband as a defensive measure. Pimps work the truck stop, she explains. They drop off girls to work the cabs as they pull up, then take them to the next stop. I know because I had a niece who got caught up with drugs, and her pimp beat her to death for trying to get out. I used to hate the girls. Now I hate the pimps. She says truckers tend to be family men. Executives are probably more likely to be Johns. And she's proud that husband and wife teams have a better safety record than men driving alone. At a fourth stop, there is a 24-hour poker game. At a fifth, there is what seems to be a permanent floating argument about cross-country trucking and whether it can flex enough political muscle to make better safety laws. In this way, we hit every major truck stop between Boston and New York. I've spent most of my life on the road, yet I've never seen this world that wakes when others sleep. My driver tells me it's global. He's met immigrant truckers looking for work who have driven English lorries, and everywhere from Eritrea's mountainous roads to the crowded streets of India, where trucks are painted with flowers and gods and goddesses, an art form that drivers carried photos of, right along with photos of their families. Back in our shared cocoon in the rain, we're quiet. The rhythm of our windshield wipers merges in my head with Brooke Benton's sensuous baritone. It's a rainy night in Georgia, and it looks like it's raining all over the world. I see Manhattan lights reflecting into the night sky, but I've lost all sense of time. This could go on forever. I realize I've been swimming in the shallows, and am only now discovering the deeps where the great whales meet. I'm having lunch at West Hollywood's Cafe Figaro with Florence Kennedy. She's explaining to me that she quit being a lawyer because the law is a one-ass-at-a-time proposition, and what you have to do is stop the ringer. This is inspired by the sight of seven waitresses and no waiters, an index of suspicion. Flo says tips are probably being used as a legal excuse to pay less than the minimum wage. We quiz the manager. He assures us the pay is terrific. All seven waitresses adore their jobs, and more women are waiting in line. Back home in New York a week later, I find a letter waiting from those waitresses. We don't think any other occupational group can appreciate what you do for women as much as we. It's not enough that we work hard for ridiculously low wages. We're expected to softly come on to male customers so that they'll spend more and return again. Our wonderful male manager advances the theory that it's really to our benefit. We'll get bigger tips. God, what an intellectual cripple. Don't ever let up. The subversive seven. Now, it's decades later, in 2014. I'm reading about beloved comedian and actor Bill Cosby, who has been accused by no fewer than 39 women of drugging and sexually assaulting them at some time in the past. Each one feared she would not be believed, but when one came forward, they all began to. One is Linda Joy Traits, who at 19 was a waitress at Cafe Figaro, where Cosby dropped in occasionally because he was its part owner. He offered her a ride home, then in his car, she says that she was confronted by a briefcase full of drugs and booze, plus his sexual assault. I wish Flo were here to learn her instincts were right. 18 years older than I, with a life that stretched from seeing her parents threatened by the Ku Klux Klan to becoming a civil rights and show business lawyer, she was nearly always right. Traveling with her was better than any college education. I once saw her buy a purple pantsuit for a young white sales girl in a small-town dress shop, something the sales girl wanted but could never have afforded. When I went back after Flo's death, that now middle-aged woman told me Flo's generosity had opened up a new view of life. In 1980, I board a crowded plane for Detroit and find myself seated among a group of Hasidic Jews. The men are wearing wide-brimmed black fedoras over their yarmulkes. The women are in dark-haired wigs and long-sleeved dresses, and the children are as neat and well-behaved as miniature grown-ups. I notice some hurried rearranging of seats. The goal seems to be that no woman sits next to a man, not her husband, or next to me. My seatmate turns out to be the oldest man, stooped and gentle, reading his prayer book. knowing that no Hasidic man is allowed to touch a woman outside his family, not even to shake hands, I do my best to be respectful and keep my arm off our shared armrest. Still, I'm surprised that separating me from the women seemed to be a higher priority than isolating me from the men. I hear the word feminist in English amid the Yiddish from two young men sitting in front of us, and they peer back at me.